Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was Mary Boleyn, and how did her life intersect with that of her ill-fated sister Anne, beheaded by her husband on charges of treason most scholars consider unconvincing? Although Mary Boleyn was believed to be more physically beautiful than her younger sister, and in fact was a mistress to both Henry and to the French King Francois I, my guest today finds no evidence to support Mary's modern reputation as a manipulative and promiscuous woman. In fact, she was forced to live in exile after eschewing politically advantageous coupling and marrying a low-ranking official for love alone. So why has Mary Boleyn been so maligned in popular imagination? Historian and author Alison Weir explains what she has learned in her new book, Mary Boleyn, The Mistress of Kings. Welcome to Think.
Hi there.
Alison, you have already written extensively on the life of Anne Boleyn. What was it about Mary that you found so intriguing as well?
Well, I've researched her over a period of 40 years, but not in any great depth. But I was aware that there were many myths and misrepresentations. And I wanted to set the record straight, basically. But also, this has been a subject dear to my heart for a long time. A subject like Mary Boleyn has been a footnote to history until very recent years. And so it's nice to have the opportunity to write a biography of her.
So tell us a little bit about their family of origin and the role that Thomas Boleyn played in the Tudor court.
Well, the Boleyns came from a trading family. Yeah, the great-grandfather had been a mercer and became Lord Mayor of London and was knighted. And, was on the up, made an aristocratic marriage. Thomas Boleyn was a brilliant courtier and diplomat, a crafty statesman, an expert jouster, and a great linguist. And these were qualities, they were all very useful at the Tudor court. It made him much admired and very, he became very friendly with Henry VIII.
And he was ambitious not only for himself, but also for his daughters.
He was indeed. He was a very ruthless man. They said that his main priority was self-interest. And that was really apparent when he showed himself willing to participate in the destruction of two of his children to save his neck and save his career.
So for a while, there had been some debate about which sister was older. What convinces you that Mary was, in fact, born first?
The fact, because we have a claim by her grandson that states that his grandmother was the elder of the two. There is some other evidence as well, but secondary arguments for that. Also, Mary was married first. And that's a great indicator because girls were usually married off in order of seniority.
Hmm. How did their personalities differ, Anne's and Mary's?
We don't know a lot about Mary's personality, but I would say that of the two Boleyn sisters, Anne shone, and Mary was very much in her shade. I don't think Mary had Anne's brains or determination.
Mm-hmm. But she was the more beautiful of the two?
Yes, she was. Her father's chaplain said she was by far the more beautiful of the Boleyn sisters.
So why was Mary sent to the court of Francois I of France?
Her father was a diplomat, and he must have pulled some diplomatic strings. In the autumn of 1514, Henry VIII's sister, Mary Tudor, who was 18, was going to marry the King of France. And she had need of young girls of good birth who could speak fluent French to attend on her. And Mary does appear to have inherited her father's aptitude for languages, and that's probably why she was chosen.
Can you talk about what, we hear this term lady-in-waiting. What exactly were the duties of a lady-in-waiting?
Well, she was actually a maid of honor, mm-hmm. which is slightly more lowly post. Of course, she didn't have the title. She wasn't a married woman. Mm-hmm. But she would have attended to the personal needs of her mistress, helping her to dress and, helping to mend and make her clothes. She would generally have just looked after her.
And so she would have been only a teenager herself in her mid-teen years when she had this brief affair with Francois. How do we know?
That's correct. Yes, yeah. She could have been anything between about 14 and 18.
And how do we know about that relationship?
Because we only know about it because of an observation the papal nuncio in Paris made more than 20 years later in 1536 when he said that King Francis had known Mary here in France as a great whore, the most infamous of them all.
And was it sort of the expectation that any woman who was in the court might be made mistress of the king?
No, it wasn't. So it was certainly to be hoped the opposite. girls who went to court were usually placed there by their families in the hope they would attract a good marriage.
Mm-hmm. Was there any emotional component to these kinds of relationships, or were these young women strictly used for the sexual gratification of the king, his mistresses?
I think that in Mary Boleyn's case, almost certainly with Henry VIII, yes, I think that was the case. It was the king's sexual gratification. I don't think her her inclinations came into it at all. We don't know what sort of emotional relationship she had with either of her royal lovers, or with her husbands, for that, her first husband, for that matter. We do know her second marriage was a love match. We've got enough testimony to that in a letter.
But Mary was not at the time disgraced by the affair with Francois. In fact, the French court, I guess, I take it was a pretty wild place.
It was indeed. It was a great cultural and artistic centre, the best in Christendom. But it was a byword for licentiousness, and gallantry was the order of the day, but it was a cesspit, actually.
So what brought her back to England?
A marriage was arranged for her. She disappears from history for 5 years after leaving the court of France. I've got a theory that she was perhaps still living in France at a chateau southeast of Paris, but we can't say that for certain. But she reappears in 1520 at the English court when she marries William Carey, a cousin of the king and a rising star at court.
And this was definitely a, you mentioned an arranged marriage. This was one that was thought to be advantageous to the entire family.
It was indeed, because Carey was the king's cousin and highly favoured by Henry, and he was a member of the king's privy chamber, and that's one of the most sought-after posts at court. So he's definitely on the up and a major mover and player within the king's circle. And it's very advantageous for Sir Thomas Boleyn to have a son-in-law in such an influential position. And of course, as far as Carey's concerned, Sir Thomas Boleyn is a rising courtier. So it's a mutually beneficial union.
Mm-hmm. And was Carey much older than Mary Boleyn?
No, about the same age. Mm-hmm. Or a little bit older, perhaps. We don't know.
So it was during this marriage that she was taken as a mistress by Henry VIII, who at that point was married to Catherine of Aragon?
That's correct, yes. I believe it was during her marriage, and I think we've got some pointers that the affair began 2 years after the marriage in 1522.
Mm-hmm. And this was not a consensual affair, as far as you can tell?
We've got some evidence in a treatise of 1538 written by Henry's exiled cousin, Cardinal Pole, who was residing in Italy and had access to information in the Vatican about this affair, which had been kept very secret. He accused Henry in a treatise, face to face, and said to him, you violated this girl and kept her as your mistress. Now, at that time, the word violate did not imply any consent on the part of the woman. It meant rape or ravishment.
And I suppose, though, if the king wants you as his mistress and you're, 18 years old or 20 years old, you just don't have any choice but to say okay.
You don't really, no, unless you want to bring down some, the anger of your king on your family or your husband. Henry would have probably shown through grants to her husband he was prepared to be generous.
Is there any indication that William Carey knew about this affair?
No, none.
And what about Catherine of Aragon?
I think it's almost certain she didn't know, because by sleeping with Mary Boleyn and then wanting to marry Mary's sister Anne Boleyn, Henry was rendering his proposed marriage with Anne as incestuous as he was claiming his marriage to Catherine was. She'd been married to his brother. And if Catherine had known this, she could have made political capital out of it and exposed him as a hypocrite.
And of course, we will we'll hold on to that little fact, because it will come up later when we
get
to the discussion of the beheading of Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
This is so interesting to me, though, Alison,
Thank you.
Despite his willingness to have mistresses, not to mention six wives, you describe Henry as something of a prude.
He was indeed. I mean, the few references we have him banishing lewd women from his court, closing all the brothels in Southwark, south of London, and blushing when it suggested that he might like to try out a number of proposed royal brides before settling on one. And there are other instances as well. But no, I think this is a king who treated his wives with reverence, actually, which is quite surprising considering his reputation. But he said, who does not tremble when he considers how to deal with his wife? And that he must so treat her that when God who gave demands his own again, he can return her pure and without stain.
I mean, how virtuous was Henry? I mean, was he really concerned about God looking down upon him, or was he a guy who needed to sort of have church approval to do what he wanted to do but didn't really think it applied to him?
He wanted church approval for his marriages, but there's plenty of evidence, fragmentary because he was so discreet, that he had plenty of flings and extramarital affairs. And he usually strayed when his wives were pregnant, when sex would have become taboo.
That's a really interesting thing, that when a woman was known to be pregnant, was it thought to be dangerous or simply just untoward?
Yes, I think it was, yes.
Okay. So Mary was Henry's mistress when she was married to William Carey.
Yes.
If he didn't know about it, then he would not have ever suspected that those two children that she bore him were not his.
Well, one wonders. We just don't know. We can speculate endlessly as to whether he did know and kept quiet about it, just put up with it, or whether he was very hurt by it. We just don't know. But to all intents and purposes, he acknowledged those children, they were given his name, and they were treated as his lawful children.
And he died when the children were quite young.
He did. He died in 1528 when the children were 3 and 4.
And he had this strange sort of plague called sweating sickness. Can you tell us about this disease?
Yes. The latest theory, we're not quite sure what the sweating sickness was. It's a disease that plagued Tudor England. It appeared in 1485, the year the dynasty came to the throne, and it last appeared in the 1550s. Hmm. So there's endless theories as to what it was. The latest is that it was a version of the Spanish flu, the outbreak that occurred in 1918 to 19.
Which makes some sense in that it wasn't known to strike very young children who often are victims of something like a really serious flu.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but it did strike. I mean, they said it struck young and old alike, but I think they're talking about adults. And also, what was so terrifying was the speed at which it struck. A man could be well in the morning and 3 hours later be dead.
Do we know anything about how Henry felt about Mary Boleyn?
All we know is that he fancied her and that he stayed with her for just under 2 years, I think.
Mm-hmm. How would they have gotten together and kept this whole thing secret? I mean, it doesn't seem like the court is a place that you get a lot of privacy.
Mary was one of the king's inner circle, and that came about because she was married to a member of his privy chamber, and members of the privy chamber were allowed courtier lodgings at court, and she would have had the right to live there at court with him and the four servants who shared their lodging. And therefore, she would have come into the orbit of the king's inner circle, and he would have got to know her, if he hadn't already known her before, you know, because the Boleyns were well known to him and well liked by him from the time of his accession.
Did the Boleyn family know what was going on?
I'm sure they must have done.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we don't have any evidence. The problem with this affair is that we only know about it from later sources. There's only a couple of indications about when it started. But there's nothing else at the time to tell us. So far from being the really scandalous affair that's often portrayed in films or in books or even in history books, there's no evidence. There was no scandal. People didn't know about it.
So it would have been only, I suppose, the lowest level of sort of chamber servants who would have witnessed this, and they knew to keep their mouths shut.
Yes, they would have done. Yes, because there were. I mean, she could have been smuggled into the king's rooms quite easily. You know, there were secret stairs in the passage in the palaces. You know, meetings could have been contrived quite easily. He was the king. This sort of thing could be arranged.
Did he give her any gifts that you know of?
No, not during their affair. No, he made a series of grants to William Carey. But again, these grants could have been made on the basis of Carey being an up and coming courtier and having a career at court, and they could have been done for his good service.
And
could also have been incentives or rewards.
And how often would someone like Mary Boleyn have been allowed to leave court and go about her business elsewhere? Was she sort of living there full time during this period?
Oh, yes. I mean, she didn't have a formal role there. She could come and go as she pleased, and people did. But she had no formal... It's often said that she was a lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon. That's not true. As the wife of a member of the Privy Chamber, she had the right to... She could be called upon to serve the Queen as an extra lady-in-waiting when the Queen wished. It seems that Mary served Catherine of Aragon on only one occasion at the Field of Cloth of Gold.
Hmm. And there's no telling how well they liked each other or whether Mary felt any guilt.
Nothing at all, no. This is the problem. There's so much we don't know.
Hmm. Author and historian Alison Weir is my guest. We're talking this hour about her new book, Mary Boleyn, The Mistress of Kings. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can get on the line now. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and historian Alison Weir. Her new book is called Mary Boleyn, The Mistress of Kings. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Alison, what sort of education and training for life would the Boleyn girls have received?
They were afforded a really good education, and we know about this mainly because we know quite a lot about Anne Boleyn's interests and her accomplishments, and we can infer from that quite a lot about her education. They were very literate. They were widely read. They were taught to speak. You know, Sir Thomas was very interested in them being taught languages. Anne had to have specialist coaching, but Mary doesn't seem to have needed it. We know that Mary could write a competent letter. We know also that she liked reading books on kings and queens. We don't know very much more about her education. We have to infer what it was like from Anne's.
How much correspondence of theirs remains, if any?
For Anne, there's quite a few letters, but for Mary, there are two. One very short one, just a few lines, asking someone to confer a grant, and one very long one, pleading to be restored, to be pardoned of her banishment from court for marrying an unsuitable husband.
Yes, so how long was she single before she married William Stafford?
For 6 years.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a long time to wait. It's surprising that her family didn't find someone else that they felt suitable as a husband for her.
She was left an impoverished widow, and she didn't have any money. Her father had probably already paid a dowry for her.
Mm-hmm.
William Carey had not left her very well off indeed. In fact, the king came to her rescue. But Thomas Boleyn didn't even want to give her house room. He wouldn't listen to her pleas when she was left impoverished. And the king himself ordered him to look to his responsibilities and take her under his charge. So Thomas Boleyn begrudgingly allowed her to come and live with him. And she went to Hever Castle. Clearly, as Anne Boleyn's career advanced, she was an embarrassment to the Boleyns because she was a walking reminder of the impediment to Henry's marriage with Anne.
Let's talk about that, because ultimately the reason that Anne was beheaded for treason was the fact that Henry had, in fact, had this affair with Mary Boleyn years before Anne and Henry were married, when Henry was still married to Catherine of Aragon. Obviously, he knew all this going in. This was no secret. It was no secret to Anne Boleyn. How in the world was he able to make this argument that, therefore, their marriage was invalid?
It's a long story. Much of it is speculative, but in 1528, when Henry knew he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, he was well aware of this impediment because he asked secretly if the Pope could give him a general dispensation, not naming any names, allowing him to marry within the first degree of relationship. Now, that meant he could have married his mother or his daughter.
Mm.
And the Pope granted this dispensation, knowing it was safe to do so because he was never going to annul Henry's marriage.
1-800.
So there was that. But then again, after the Reformation, Henry and Anne married on the strength of this. But after the Reformation, it was said that certain papal dispensations were, unless they were canonically, authentic, secure, were worthless. And that's how they got over the impediment when it came to annulling Henry's marriage to Anne.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Barbara in Dallas. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. I was wondering, in your 2001 book, The King and His Court, you noted that Mary's mother had an affair with Henry VIII. Did you discover any additional support of this occurring?
No, in fact, I think I must have, I sort of rejected that story at that time, and I still do. But I did discover no less than 10 16th century sources making this allegation. You can reject them all on good grounds. But I did find some other evidence in a poem by the poet laureate John Skelton, a satirical poem, that strongly suggests that Elizabeth Howard had a reputation for infidelity. So these rumors were probably credible. But I do think that her name was confused with that of Elizabeth Blount, one of Henry's earlier mistresses, because the name Boleyn can be spelt in so many different ways, and one form was Boulant, and you can see how this was probably confused with Blount.
And Elizabeth Blount was the mistress of Henry's who gave birth to the only illegitimate child that he officially acknowledged.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Boy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And why this child?
Well, he wanted a son. He was desperate for a son. And it was almost saying to the world, look, I can father sons, but my wife can't give me one. This was after Catherine of Aragon had borne six children. And just one was, one, there were three sons. They all died young. And he only had one girl to show for it.
Why did he need a son when ultimately it was his daughter, Elizabeth I, who became queen? What was the difference?
He didn't know how successful a queen Elizabeth was going to be. He'd have been astonished, I think. The English had only ever had one, since the conquest, had only ever had one example of an almost queen regnant, and that was Matilda in the 12th century, who lasted 2 weeks. Because she was so haughty and arrogant, the Londoners sent her packing. And after that, I think the experience was one they didn't want to repeat. But there was also this concept that it was unnatural and unlawful for a woman to wield dominion over men.
Hmm.
And so there was this insurmountable sort of cultural barrier to it.
What did Henry do? Let's talk about the parentage of Mary Boleyn's children. You are fairly well convinced that her daughter Catherine, it's interesting that she named her children Catherine and Henry, you're convinced that her daughter Catherine was quite likely the daughter of Henry VIII.
I think so. I came to this book thinking that if they'd been his children, he would have acknowledged them, but I've revised that opinion. Because I looked at it always around, I thought, well, he didn't need to acknowledge them because the law said that any children born by a married woman were automatically deemed those of her husband.
Mm-hmm.
There was no need to acknowledge them. But I also found out that he had another illegitimate daughter whom he didn't acknowledge, and that was probably because her mother was too low born.
So would he did some things to care for her children, did he not?
Yes, he did. Well, we don't know for certain, but there, after Mary had been, Henry had insisted that Thomas Boleyn take Mary under his roof and so that she would be at his charge, he had no need to do anything further to her. But what he did was, later that year, he restored to her a pension that had been her husband's, and that was £100 a year, which is £32,000 now, so it's a very large amount of money. He had no need to do that. But it may be significant because it may be that he was paying maintenance for his daughter. He paid this to Carey. So perhaps he was just continuing what he'd done before. And this was done at Anne Boleyn's behest.
Hmm.
There's also evidence later of Mary being especially helped out financially and in other ways.
What do we know about Henry's personality? You know, from all the things he did, he just sounds like a really an evil human being. Was he charming in certain situations?
He could be very charming. In fact, when he was young, he won golden opinions from everyone. And I think that he would have continued to do so had he not suffered from 7 years of frustration. That was because he wanted an annulment of his marriage. Apart from his passion for Anne Boleyn, he had a genuine concern for the succession. He'd been brought up to believe that the wars of Lancaster and York had been very severe and very violent and bloody, and he didn't want a repeat of that. And he needed a son. He didn't have one, and this is his tragedy. But the Pope was refusing to annul his marriage for political, not theological reasons. And Henry did have a good case. There had been doubts raised about the marriage before it was even made. So you can see the king's frustration. And then at the same time, Anne Boleyn's holding him at arm's length for 6-7 years. And he's feeling that he's being very hard done by.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is this problem with the succession. And, of course, when Anne bears him only a daughter, and then, you know, the marriage goes spectacularly wrong, he still hasn't got a son. And he's 45, and that's getting on in those days.
Mm-hmm. So it was during the time that Henry and Anne were married that Anne Boleyn gave birth, that Anne Boleyn married and showed up married to William Stafford. Is that correct?
Anne Boleyn was queen. She'd been queen just over a year. And Mary appeared at court pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she was supposed to be a widow. No one knew she'd married, but she had married, she confessed, she had married secretly this plain Mr. William Stafford, a younger son of a knightly house, very distantly related to the Stafford Dukes of Buckingham, and that she'd married for love. And that was regarded as akin to insanity by the landed Tudor classes. So, she'd offended in so many respects. But I think most of all, she'd offended Anne, because Anne, because she was queen, was now regarded as the head of her family. She should have deferred to her and at least asked her permission, but she hadn't done so.
And so it was Anne that requested that Mary and William Stafford be exiled.
Yes, the Boleyns were up in arms, but Anne was the most incensed, and she prevailed upon Henry immediately to banish the couple from court.
Is there any is there any indication that he said, this is not really necessary, but I'll do it for you?
No, he was angry.
Mm-hmm.
And because Mary, in her letter to Thomas Cromwell, the king's chief minister, written about 3 months later, asked she wants to regain the king's and the queen's favour.
Hmm. So what did Mary and William do at this point?
We don't know where they went initially. They may have gone to his father's house at Cotterade in Hertfordshire, north of London, because Hever Castle by then, you know, they may not have been able to. They wouldn't have been welcome at Hever Castle. They couldn't go there. So we don't know where they were. They weren't at court, obviously. And then Mary wrote this long and impassioned letter to Thomas Cromwell, begging to be restored to favour. But she didn't go around it in a very tactful way, because she said that she'd rather beg her bread with Stafford than be the greatest queen christened. It was like sticking in the knife, because Anne's marriage was very unhappy by then.
Does that tell you that this falling out that they had as adults, that perhaps they didn't get along well as younger people? Is there any reason to think that?
I suspect that. The letter gives us the best clues, and I think Mary had been jealous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was jealous of Anne, the younger sister, going into court before her. She was jealous perhaps because Anne had sneered the king who'd rejected Mary and become queen. And I think that she had felt, probably, it's almost certain that she was quite sidelined when Anne became queen and was treated as if she was of little account. And she must have resented that. She says as much in her letter, that she was treated, all the world held her in little account.
Did Anne have any sort of affair with Henry before their marriage?
Well, she did, yes. I mean, she held him at arm's length, but certainly he'd fallen for her by February 1526. In the autumn of 1532, she became his mistress. And as soon as she was pregnant with Elizabeth, he married her in secret, even though his marriage hadn't been formally annulled.
And so was this the sort of thing that was it or was it not scandalous to sort of be discovered to have publicly had an affair with someone like Henry?
Well, yes, it was. I mean, people guessed what had happened.
Yeah.
I mean, Anne didn't sort of make much of a secret of it. You know, she was flaunting it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was considered scandalous, I think. You know, especially Elizabeth was born about just over 7 months after her parents' marriage. But it was given out that they had actually married the previous November, and that would have covered the 9 months.
Maybe not the first people to stretch the truth in that way.
No, but admiring and scraping chroniclers wrote that they married in the November, but it's not true. It was in the Archbishop of Canterbury. We have his Archbishop Cranmer's own testimony. It was on the 25th of January, 1533, and it was in secret. And she wasn't paraded in public as queen until Easter.
Were the courts very gossipy places at this point?
Oh, they were dreadful. And ambassadors recording every bit of gossip, which is wonderful. So this period, that's why this period is so interesting, because it's a period where diplomacy is spreading. And because Henry's matrimonial adventures put the royal marriage into focus, public focus, for the first time, really, in English history to a great extent, no tidbit of gossip was considered too insignificant to be recorded. And that's why it's a fascinating period to study.
Yeah, I suppose that's ideal for historians to come back later and figure things out.
Oh, it is, absolutely. But there are always gaps, as I was saying earlier, that you can't hope to fill, even with Anne Boleyn, whose life is very well documented.
Mm-hmm. So the sisters were not in communication, as far as you can tell, when Anne Boleyn was sentenced to death?
It looks as if Mary went to Calais. Her husband was a soldier at the Calais garrison, and we've got records of him doing errands for the lieutenant of Calais during this time. It's almost certain she went to live there with him, and so they were abroad. They were abroad for 5 years, and that was during the time that the Boleyns fell in 1536.
Where were William and Henry and Catherine Carey at this point?
Henry Carey was being educated at Sion Abbey, which is just near London, and in the hands of tutors under the auspices of Anne Boleyn. And then he seems to have come under the influence of a Catholic priest, and that didn't endear his guard. You know, his guardians were quite shocked about that. And then he seems to have come under the care of Sir John Russell, a courtier. Catherine Carey, we don't know about her whereabouts. She was probably with her mother, because it's after they come back to court in late 1539 in the train of Anne of Cleves, Henry's fourth wife, that Catherine is found a place as a maid of honour. Why would the obscure Catherine Carey get a place as a maid of honour? Who's pulling strings? Possibly the king himself.
Or possibly her cousin, Elizabeth I?
Elizabeth is a child at this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do we know about how well those two got along? Did Elizabeth suspect that Catherine Carey was her cousin, or was her sister rather, half sister?
If she knew, she kept it quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Again, she would have been aware that it was, you know, that Catherine was a reminder of the impediment to her parents' marriage, and that was a sensitive issue with her.
Yeah,
because when she became queen, she was warned by her advisers not to have the marriage declared lawful and valid, because it would rake up too many old scandals. So she kept quiet about it. But she adored Catherine. She was very close to Henry. She called him My Harry. She kept Catherine close to her and kept her away from her husband, even when she was dying.
How did Elizabeth feel about the fact that her mother had been put to death?
That's a huge question. It's often said that she only made two references noncommittally to Anne Boleyn in later life, but that's not true. I studied the matter for my last book, The Lady in the Tower, and there's overwhelming evidence that Elizabeth thought positively about her mother. And the first is that when she was about in her early teens, she was painted with one of Anne's initial pendants around her neck. That's in the whole, in Henry VIII family group at Hampton Court. I think the king's eyesight must have been going by then, because you'd have to crane your neck forward to see it, but certainly it's an A pendant.
It is really poignant in a way to think about that, you know, this teenage girl pining for a mother that she had scarcely known.
One wonders what sort of impact that knowledge had on her, because she couldn't have remembered it, and there's often speculation as to how she found out. I suspect she found out gradually, and I think the king ordered her to be confined to her rooms the summer after Anne was executed, and I think that indicates he didn't want her to hear all the ghastly rumours that were going around, including rumours that she wasn't his own daughter.
How common was knowledge of all of these activities and machinations outside of the court? Were there sort of public reports of what took place?
Yes, there were reports. There were ambassadors' reports. There are letters. There's the king's own order in this particular case I was just mentioning then. So, you know, we have got quite a large network of evidence, and we can construct quite a credible tale from it.
But nothing like a newspaper where just common people would read day to day.
No, nothing like that in those days. No, a lot of people were illiterate and couldn't read. We've got the growth of literacy in this period, but the reading is really the privilege of the rich and people in the church and clerks.
My guest is author and historian Alison Weir. Her new book is called Mary Boleyn, The Mistress of Kings. We do have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation and ask a question at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and historian Alison Weir. Her newest book is called Mary Boleyn, The Mistress of Kings. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Jose in Dallas. Hi, Jose. Jose, are you with us? Okay, we will try and get him back in a little bit. We also have an email here from Kathy in Dallas who says, Alison, that she has loved your work in the past. She has a question about the process of writing a history about Mary Boleyn when there is so little reliable historical evidence to go on. Kathy writes, a letter from Cardinal Pole might be biased against the Tudors as well as the records from the ambassadors. How do you go about constructing a book from so little information about Mary?
You have to weigh each piece of evidence on its own merits, and you have to look at how close people are to the subject. I don't think that Cardinal Pole would have actually addressed this treatise to Henry if he got anything in it that Henry could throw back at him. I think he's stating a fact that's quite well known.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one has, as I say, one has to look at the veracity and the reliability of every source. The problem with the biography of Mary Boleyn is that everything about is controversial, or we don't know. So a lot is speculation, a lot is argument. It's very difficult to get a balance between a strong narrative of her story and looking at all the analysis of her story. And there is, people say it's not very much known, but actually there is an awful lot. If you look at the core of knowledge, there is quite a lot. And then there is a lot else that is speculative. But it's speculative on, I think, good evidence.
Do you feel like you can get inside Mary Boleyn's head, and do you like her as a person?
I can't, you know, I honestly do not have an opinion on her. She's just too elusive. That is where there just isn't the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We can construct her life. We can construct a case for the paternity of her children, for when she became the king's mistress, for whether she was King Francis' mistress. But we don't know her. And that's the problem with subjects like that. I'll be relieved to get onto my next subject, which is Elizabeth of York, because it's a strong narrative. And yes, I think we can get to know her.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's try again for Jose in Dallas. Are you with us, Jose?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. Go right ahead.
Okay, I have a question. I know that King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella from Spain had quite a big play in the politics of Europe. They were the biggest superpower at that point.
Yes, they were. Yes.
And they married in Catherine of Aragon to King Henry VIII. Now, what exactly happened after the marriage was annulled? I know that, you know, that pretty much was a sore point with Spain and England, and that pretty much affected their relationship moving forward. Is that true or not?
Yes, it did. It did. It did temporarily. But I have to say that once Catherine was dead, the emperor, Catherine's nephew, who'd been her champion, started to move closer to Henry, and feelers were put out for an alliance.
So politics still trumped anything
it
personal.
Was, I'm afraid, yes.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Also on the line, we have Amy in Plano. Hi, Amy.
Hi. This is really exciting. It's one of the most fascinating time periods in history. I did come in a little bit late, and I was wondering if you could clarify for me the final reason that was given for the beheading of Anne Boleyn.
There were many. Well, she was beheaded for adultery with five men, one her own brother, and for plotting the king's death.
And was there truth to any of that?
I don't think so. I mean, the book's been out a while now, so I think I can comment on it. I went through the book looking for reasons to believe Anne innocent and reasons to believe her guilty, because there were points when I wrote that book when I thought I might veer either way.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three pretty flimsy reasons for believing her guilty and 15 damn good ones for believing her innocent.
And there was no defense offered to her, was there, when she was finally tried for this?
No, no. But people accused of treason were not allowed a defense.
Hmm. What sort of mother was Mary Boleyn to her children?
Again, we don't know. It looks like Henry Carey was taken from her when he was quite young and put in the care of tutors. He was only three when his father died, and so it's likely that he was left with his mother for a little bit. But before long, a tutor was found for him when he was about 10 years old, and then he would have been taken from her care, and that was not unusual. Catherine Carey seems to have stayed with her mother. We don't know very much about their relationship. Again, we don't know anything really about the relationship that was between Mary and her children.
What sort of references are there that prove that Elizabeth knew William Stafford fairly well?
She made a reference in later life, when she was queen, to saying she remembered William Stafford when she was a child at court, and she'd have seen him there when he was a gentleman pensioner, one of the guard of honour protecting the king.
So is there?
I wonder if she'd known her Aunt Mary as well, but there's no evidence that she did.
Yeah, we would love to know somehow about that.
I tried so hard to find something about that, because her fondness for her Carey cousins, or possibly her half-sister, indicates to me that she was close to the family as a whole.
Why has Mary Boleyn been so maligned, particularly after her death?
It's very odd because, well, she wasn't maligned at the time. It's literally in the 20th century, as history books have been written, and the assumption since Victorian times seems to have been made that she had a reputation. And that's been built upon by various history books. And it's like an urban legend, you know, that's repeated and repeated. And nobody really thinks about the origin of it, because in every book about Mary features, she is a peripheral character. Nobody's researching her in any depth. I've done it myself, repeated the old, you know, what other historians have said. It's only when you come to examine the evidence that you find that she had no reputation. You know, and even later on, when this affair became known, it was still kept very discreet.
Can you enjoy the fictional portrayals of these characters that you know from academic research, or do they just make you crazy?
I enjoy writing not historical fiction. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do make me cringe, yes, although there are historical novels I really know and love.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can forgive the historical inaccuracies because the novels are so well written. And I do think, though, that if you depart, you should use the facts when they exist when you're writing a historical novel. And you can fill in the gaps with your imagination. But I think what you write must be credible within the context of what is known. And if you depart from the record, you need to write an author's note to justify it.
Yeah, that does seem the perfect compromise, to take exactly the facts that can be proven and then use artistic license.
That's right, because we don't always know what people's motives were or their emotions or their private lives, you know, that kind of thing. You've got plenty of room for invention, and you can sometimes be quite daring if you want to, but you need to explain it. Because I do know, I do a huge program of events and I get lots of correspondence. I know that people care that what's in a historical novel is pretty close to the truth, because they want their history that way. They don't want to read history books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think historical novels, and even more importantly, historical films, can have a very powerful influence.
We have an email here from Martin in Fort Worth, who writes, in the late 60s or early 70s on PBS, public television here, there was a special series, a historical drama about Henry VIII.
Yes, with Keith Michelle.
Yeah. And Martin says, I seem to recall that Henry was portrayed as having syphilis, which drove him mad. Is this true?
No, not in the series, certainly. I've got the series. I know it very well. It's a series of six plays.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's made with great integrity. But there's no evidence that Henry VIII had syphilis. It's a late Victorian invention, because the Victorians felt, well, you know, six wives, you know, and he played around a bit, so he must have had syphilis. But syphilis was endemic at that time. It was like AIDS in our society, mm-hmm. or was in the 80s. And people were aware of it. Ambassadors looked for symptoms. The main cure for syphilis was mercury. And we've got all Henry's apothecary's accounts, and mercury doesn't feature at all. And if he'd been receiving treatment, he would have had side effects that ambassadors would have noted.
I'm also curious about how you go about. I mean, at some point, it seems like every historian has looked at all the known sources. Are there still places where information is turning up that you're able to look at and interpret?
Yes. Yes, I mean, for the lady in the tower, there was stuff that turned up. There were sources. One particularly long letter written about Anne Boleyn's fall to Elizabeth I on her accession. And two passages from it are quoted for in many, many books. But the rest of this very long letter, the main substance of it, is just being ignored. It's never appeared anywhere. And it throws more light onto the situation for us. There was a lot I found. Often you find that sources are quoted in part. They're not, and a lot of them are ignored. And I think you have to dig pretty deep. And sometimes sources have been noted, but they haven't been used in the right context. And if you put them all together strictly chronologically, something different might emerge.
Hmm. Do you enjoy the debates with other historians, or do you feel like once you have really gotten behind something that you feel you've proven, that you don't want to argue about it anymore?
Oh, no. If anything new comes up, I get quite excited. But it depends on what it is, of course. You know, sometimes you can see it's perhaps a half-baked theory, not very often, you know. But I do enjoy the debates, and I do always say that every history book is a contribution to the debate at that time.
Will you speak to this? This might seem like a sort of a side topic, but we think about royalty and we think about them having all these servants and wonderful food prepared for them. Was life still very uncomfortable for people, royalty in the Tudor era?
Not for royalty, no. They lived very well. I mean, people made sure their rooms were heated and they got choice food. You know, it was all organic food, freshly delivered every day. And they wore the finest clothes. They kept clean. And they had an army of servants to look after him. The only thing that the hardship they would have compared with today, apart from the lack of modern technology, was the fact that was the medical side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would really suffer. No anesthetics, no antibiotics. Diseases carried them off that would be cured today, like Henry VIII, for example, his ulcerated legs, that would have been cured quite quickly. He'd have received advice on diet.
Hmm. And Mary Boleyn actually died quite young.
She did. She died in her early to mid-40s. And we don't know the cause, but we do know that a week or so before her death, her husband, William Stafford, was arrested for eating meat on a Friday. Now, that doesn't sound very much, but this was at a time when people who were suspected of heresy were being purged at court. And Henry VIII was having a reaction to having flirted with the reformers at court. And people were being burned at the stake. If people had pressed charges against Carey, Stafford, he could have met the same fate. I wonder whether that had any bearing on Mary's death, whether she was already ill or whether the shock of it upset her. I don't know. Which is just pure speculation.
She had an inheritance that was due her that she had to fight really hard to actually receive.
She did. Yes, that's correct. She had to fight the crown for her half of the Boleyn, her Boleyn and Butler, her grandmother, her Butler grandmother's inheritance. And it took 3 years, and the grant came too late for her. She won her case, but it came 4 days before her death. She was allowed to take possession of her lands and her properties.
And again, you said we really don't know what killed her, but we do seem to know that William Stafford mourned her for some time after she died.
Well, that's what it seems. He remained a widower for 9 years, mm-hmm. and then he made another ill-advised marriage, obviously for love. So I think he was a man who thought marrying for love was a very important thing.
Do we know anything about their courtship such as it was, obviously
in
secret?
There's some speculation that they met at Anne Boleyn's coronation. He was certainly there, and so was she, of course, in Anne's train. And they may have met there. And they may have also met in Kent, because his family lived a little way from hers. But there's no evidence of that, of course. I think it's more likely to have been at the coronation, and they must have seen each other at court. And then he got the post at Calais. So they would have corresponded, probably. We have a letter from her to somebody at Calais, so it looks as if, yes, she was in touch with people in Calais.
And was their marriage essentially supported by the stipend that Henry had allowed to Mary Boleyn for the sake of her first husband, William
Carey? Yes, I think it would have been.
Mm-hmm. How much would a soldier have made?
Not a lot of money at all. I couldn't tell you for it. I'd probably have to look it up in the book. It is in the book, but I can't remember. I'm mm-hmm. sorry. But it wouldn't have been very much. But it would have been all found. Accommodation would have been provided.
Talk about...
It wouldn't have been anything like she'd had at court with her first husband.
Right. It's sort of like she just kept stepping down and down and down.
She did indeed, yes. But she was happy. She makes that very clear that she loved this man. He was about 11 years her junior. And it was a love match, and he obviously loved her for what she was, for who she was, not what she was.
It's funny that was so unusual at that time, and today it's all we want.
I know, it was thought scandalous, and nowadays we get upset because Prince Charles says something like, "Well, whatever love is," when asked about whether he loved Princess Diana. You know, it was the other way around in Tudor times. You know, mm-hmm. if Henry VIII had said that about one of his queens, about Catherine of Aragon, you know, people wouldn't have worried.
What do you
People
think?
Would never have asked the question. It would have been assumed, because love is the duty of married couples.
What do you think makes this story so enduringly fascinating? I mean, you're a historian, but there are many people who come to your work that don't do this for a living that just cannot get enough of it.
I know. People can't get enough of the Tudor period, full stop. It never ceases to amaze me. You'd think it had been done to death, but it hasn't. The demand is still there. And I write about it because I've been passionately interested in it for 45 years now. And it's something that I don't think is ever going to go away. And I think that it's a fascinating period because the story of the royalty at this time is very dramatic. You've got dynamic characters. This is a period for which we've got a lot of evidence about the private lives of monarchs. We've got a great visual record. It's a magnificent period. We have survivals of wonderful palaces and houses. And art, paintings. We've got portraiture coming to fruition. It's a wonderful period to study compared with the sparseness of evidence for the medieval period before it.
The new book by historian and author Alison Weir is called Mary Boleyn, the Mistress of Kings. Alison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.